Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an update on the Mueller investigation and explore its various threads, along with other cases brought by Mueller, handed off to the U.S. Attorney's offices in Manhattan and Washington and the Department of Justice's National Security Division. Harry Litman, a former United States attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, joins us to discuss his article at CNN, Indictments of 12 Russians Has Stunning Implications, and the latest revelation that the Mueller team wants to talk to the so-called Manhattan Madam. We'll also look into the possibility that Trump's mistreatment of his loyal fixer, Michael Cohen, will come back to haunt him now that Cohen's lawyers have leaked the existence of a tape recording between Trump and Cohen discussing a payoff of hush money to a playmate weeks before the 2016 election. Given the history of tape recordings bringing down presidents, as was the case with Nixon at Watergate, we will assess the possibility that covering up sexual relations, which was the best that special counsel Ken Starr could come up with from his witch hunt in pursuit of Clinton, will be Trump's undoing, in spite of the recent troubling evidence that Putin appears to have an undisclosed malign influence over Trump. Then, with leaks from inside the White House that President Trump is becoming increasingly unhinged as he desperately tries to keep one step ahead of the sheriff by pulling off reality TV stunts on a daily basis to distract the press and feed his base instead of governing, we will speak with Lance Dodas, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is a contributor to the recent book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. He joins us to discuss the increasing pressure of narcissistic mortification undoing Trump as the reality of his incompetence and amateurism becomes overwhelming. Then finally, we will speak with a specialist on Nicaragua, Jeff Thale, the Vice President for Programs at the Washington Office of Latin America, who focuses on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in Central America. He joins us to discuss the violent repression of student protesters by government vigilante thugs and the irony that Nicaragua, under Daniel Ortega's increasingly brutal dictatorship, is beginning to resemble the Somoza regime, which Ortega helped topple in 1979. And joining us now is Harry Litman, a former United States attorney appointed by President Bill Clinton and a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at CNN, The Indictments of 12 Russians Has Stunning Implications. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thanks, Ian. Boy, that's hard to say with one breath. There's a lot going on here.
Well, that's the curse of having to cover Trump on a daily basis. You get whipsawed all the time, and I'm sure you're equally exhausted by it. So let's talk about some of these threads. What's your sense of, well, the most tantalizing, of course, the latest thread of the Mueller inquiry is that he wants to talk to the Manhattan Madam. What do we know about her, and what could she possibly bring to the table?
We don't know a lot, and I think if she didn't have the prior notoriety, it might not have been the big headline that it is. What we know about her, though, is she's an associate of Roger Stone. So he seems to be, and this would be a exciting development, in the barrel as a result of the indictment of the 12 that you just mentioned. The big thing about the latest spate of developments is they seem to be linking up. They go far, all the way back to the Russian government on the one hand, and all the way forward to political operatives, including close people to the campaign. So Roger Stone is a clear person of interest now. In the indictment of the 12, he's listed, he's called by a pseudonym, by person A, because one because of DOJ policy, but he is, by his own description, someone who was talking regularly with President Trump. And so they're focused very much on him, and the Manhattan Madam is, as part of his colorful history, a good friend. I think he managed her campaign for political office. and they just are, you know, hang out and are pals together. So I think Mueller's interest in her is surely about what she can tell them about Roger Stone. So for purposes of the probe, it's the tangible indication, further indication that Stone is in the crosshairs.
But it would seem obvious, at least it is to me, Harry Littman, that if the GRU under Putin's instructions targeted the DNC, Hillary Clinton, and Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, which they appear to have done, wouldn't it make sense for them to be giving Trump real-time information about the Hillary Clinton campaign? In other words, giving Trump the ability to literally read her mail, to know what exactly is going on in terms of her thinking, her strategies, and her campaign, that would be the real value. It seems like, to my mind, there were American interlocutors along with those 12 GRU military officers indicted. That seems logical to me, and my sense is that there's some other shoes to drop, not just Roger Stone.
I think it is shoe-dropping season. The GRU mentioned, indictment mentioned more than one. And certainly what you say is right, but it becomes almost a geopolitical question that's hard to evaluate. They certainly gave a lot of value to the Trump campaign, whether or not there was a, private line from Russian military intelligence to Manafort or Trump, as their or to Manafort as there may have been, just by the kind of previous indictment of the false tweets and other things in the sort of heartland, and then here the actual hacking. So yeah, the mother lode would have been to turn it immediately over, not or through WikiLeaks. That would have been an extra step that might have taken a little bit of coordination. But that's probably what among the general topics at the June meeting that we've heard so much about. So I don't think we can say that. That Mueller is there, but he needn't be in order to make a very powerful case of what's often called kind of poorly collusion.
Well, it's almost, I think, I don't know that that's a fact, but it certainly is a suspicion that if there was a back channel set up, and we know that Jared Kushner tried to set up one through Ambassador Kislyak, it would seem to me that there is an operating back channel to this day. The Russian woman, Butina, she was interested in, she was working on sending information about who would be Trump's choice for Secretary of State. And there's growing evidence
that
the Russians, that the Russians vetoed. Trump initially thought that Mitt Romney would be Secretary of State, but apparently the Russians vetoed that and encouraged him to get the former Exxon head, who Putin knew personally and gave the biggest civilian award to. And another piece of evidence is that just ahead of the G7, which took place in Canada recently and was a complete fiasco, apparently Theresa May wanted a communique or a unanimous communique from the G7 condemning Russia for the nerve gas attack in Salisbury in the UK. And just ahead of G7, suddenly out of the blue, without telling anybody, Trump says he wants to readmit Putin back into the G7. Again, it's almost like Trump is following Putin's instructions.
Yeah. I mean, almost like there's a Dixie cup between them and they have the information. It is like that. And I think increasingly in the last few weeks, there have been some very credible journalists, Josh Marshall comes to mind, who've actually come out and said, look, there's no other supposition left. I think he's got to be some kind of Russian asset. I see all that, I see the logic of it. I just want to put my faith and stock in Mueller's investigation and sort of methodical calling out of the facts. So for that investigation, we're not there yet, but we're getting tantalizingly close to the actual connection between Russian government, not just sort of unnamed foreigners, and actual campaign, including in the Butina indictment. So I will, you know, be avidly curious, as is everyone, to see how Mueller stitches that up. I see these logical suppositions, and, you know, truth has been stranger than fiction for the last couple years. But I think for now, they're in the unsubstantiated category.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who currently is a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at CNN, "The Indictments of 12 Russians Has Stunning Implications." So turning to Michael Cohen, it does seem as though we know that Trump is a narcissist and doesn't care about anybody but himself. And it looks as though his mistreatment of Michael Cohen may have backfired. Cohen, of course, being his loyal fixer, and he obviously wanted an appointment in the White House, and Trump could have given him some kind of sinecure, but instead he just cut him loose. And it looks as though the tape recordings that I believe it was Cohen's lawyers that leaked the existence of these tape recordings between Cohen and Trump discussing a payoff of hush money to a playmate weeks before the 2016 elections. Just before coming on the air today, Harry, I had a long conversation with an old friend of mine, Alexander Butterfield, who was the person who released the existence of the White House recordings during Watergate, which it was the undoing of President Nixon. And by the way, Judge Kavanaugh, who Trump has nominated to be on the Supreme Court, he apparently, has in his writings, has said that it was a mistake for Nixon to hand over those tapes. That's something we can talk about if you like. But in general, put this in an historic context, if you will. Do you think that tape recordings, which were the undoing of one president, could be the undoing of a second?
Well, I have to think there are more. Remember the context here. This is a face-to-face meeting. So Trump comes in, starts talking about this thing, and Cohen, you know, has some apparatus that you know, picks things up for a couple minutes. But he has to have, you know, been very sort of hesitant and nervous about using it. Compare that to the ease of turning on a tape recorder when somebody calls on the phone. So the first thing is that I would not credit, I wouldn't credit Rudy Giuliani if he said today was Sunday, but I certainly wouldn't credit this idea that that's the only tape around. So there may be many, and as was the case with Nixon, and as a former prosecutor, I can tell you, actual tapes in the defendant's or witness's own voice are the most powerful evidence, and to really, you know, hear Trump in a way that demonstrates, among other things, that he lied so flatly, I would think would be powerful. On the other hand, we know that everybody understands he's a incorrigible liar, and at least 40% of the country, you know, doesn't seem to have abandoned him for that reason. But I think it really stands to reason that Cohen is the keeper of a lot of the secrets. And remember, they served this, you know, they swooped in for a search warrant because they were worried about destruction of the evidence. And he had like 12 phones and several, you know, there's just such a wealth here and also such a wealth in his mind. And you're 100% right. He's one of the in a long line of people who have been totally mistreated by, you know, the supposed boss. And that's the kind of thing that prosecutors really like to point out when they're talking cooperation. Why do you want to be loyal to him? Look how he was to you. So it does seem that it's moving that way. It does seem he'll have a lot to say, and it does seem that there will be multiple tapes. They'll probably concern their previous, you know, relationship pre his tenure, but it's going to be powerful stuff.
So, do you think though that Cohen's lawyers, Lenny Davis, the assumption is that that's where the leak of the existence of these tapes came from. Are they trying to...
I've really puzzled over that.
Right.
Because nothing makes a lot of sense there. I wouldn't think that that would endear him very well to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Mm-hmm.
If he leaked it, and you know, I don't see why it would be in his interest to leak it. That's, I think, a big mystery. Secondary to the content of the tape is what really matters. But
sure.
I've heard that rumor, but I'm not sure whether to credit it. But sorry,
I'm glad you clarified that. But do you think that Cohen is trying to signal to Trump, you know, take care of me, or I'm going to take care of myself?
I think we're past that. I think he's already signaled, as it were, that he is going to be taking care of himself, and he knows his boss's character. If there were any doubt, this morning's tweet from Trump is a declaration of war. So I don't think he could be confidently, in any event, playing for the pardon now. I think he probably has only one real move. It's a painful one for him, but I think it's, you know, he will be cooperating.
Well, that says a lot about Trump, doesn't it? His lawyers must be tearing their hair out that he's so self-destructive, in the sense that what would it have cost him to be nice and take care of his loyal fixer?
And again, you know, it's a long line. Yeah, he really does alienate everybody. All the people who have left the White House going way back. You have Trump is so, he's supposedly this strong leader, and yet he's the opposite. He is so nasty and virulent to the most loyal among him, and then he's kowtows and sycophantic to American enemies. It's to me the very posture of a weak and pusillanimous leader.
Well, just in closing, it's pretty clear that Trump, working with Devin Nunes and the Tea Party caucus in the House, are trying to gin up an excuse to fire Rod Rosenstein by making impossible demands on him to hand over Mueller's work product, top secret stuff involving sources and methods, putting witnesses in danger for their lives. It would end up on Fox News in a heartbeat. That seems to be in the wind. I noticed that when Rosenstein was at the Aspen summit on national security, at which the DNI got into trouble by speaking truth about Trump, Rosenstein got a massive standing ovation before he even opened his mouth. So there's obviously a contrast there between these kind of junkyard dogs on the House so-called Freedom Caucus wanting to get him at all costs with, they'll do anything. And on the other hand, this investment that so many people have in Rosenstein's decency and honor.
I think that's right. And I think he has really, in the last couple months, become more muscular in defense of the department and the whole mission. And it's tied up, I would say, in the overall success of the Mueller probe itself. So these two recent indictments, even though one isn't from Mueller, and now especially the Manafort trial, which starts Wednesday, they call this a witch hunt, notwithstanding that there's never been an allegation that Mueller has made that hasn't been credited, including mainly by guilty pleas. Now we have the first person who's come out and said, it's not true, prove it. If it goes to trial on Wednesday, Mueller will prove it and will prove it conclusively. And I think that will make it yet harder for Nunes and company to be continuing the witch hunt refrain.
But, of course, clearly Manafort is up for bank fraud. I mean, isn't this more pressure on him from the special counsel? I guess there's a connection, because he was so afraid of Deripaska, the oligarch thug that he had, I think, borrowed 20 million or 30 million from.
Yeah.
And he was desperately committing bank fraud in order to come up with money to pay off this guy. And the minute, of course, he became Trump's campaign manager, all was forgiven. Deripaska was offered private briefings of, and they changed the Republican platform to accommodate the Russians.
Yes, there's certainly a connection, although that particular story will be secondary in the trial, which is more about money laundering. But my only point is, there has been some success in this drumbeat against Mueller. Apparently 14% more people than a few months ago think poorly of the probe. But as the probe continues to garner results and really no contradiction at all to what Mueller is doing, I just think it strengthens the hand of Rosenstein and weakens the hand of Nunes.
Well, Harry Lipman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Harry. And again, I've been speaking with Harry Lipman, who's a former United States attorney and deputy assistant attorney general in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. And he has an article at CNN, "The Indictments of 12 Russians Has Stunning Implications." We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into leaks from inside the White House that President Trump is becoming increasingly unhinged.
Why, oh, why do they come? Got to be something. I guess they like my policy. Maybe you like policy. No, it's true. Have you ever noticed? You never hear that. You never hear that. You never hear it. I mean, there's got to be a reason. I have broken more Elton John records. He seems to have a lot of records. And we beat, and I, by the way, I don't have a musical instrument. I don't have a guitar or an organ. No organ. Elton has an organ. And lots of other people helping. No, we've broken a lot of records. We've broken virtually every record because, you know, look, I only need this space. They need much more room. For basketball, for hockey, for all the sports, they need a lot of room. We don't need it. We have people in that space. So we break all these records. But really, we do it without, like, the musical instruments. This is the only musical, the mouth. It's, and hopefully the brain attached to the mouth, right? The brain, more important than the mouth, is the brain. The brain is much more important.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Lance Dodas, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodas is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the recent book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lance Dodas.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lance. And there have been some leaks from inside the White House that President Trump is increasingly isolated, doesn't really listen to anybody, and is just acting impetuously because he watches television and then he has to react all the time. That he's not really governing, he's kind of, I refer to it as government by stunt, where on a daily basis he pulls off these reality TV stunts. Like, for example, the sudden invitation to Putin to come to Washington in the fall at the height of the campaign. That's the last thing the Republicans want. Is to be reminded of Russian interference in our elections just before the election. But yet Trump did this because he was apparently watching TV and got angry at the director of national intelligence, Dan Coats, making remarks that he thought were disloyal. So he immediately tells his national security advisor to shoot out this invitation. And then, of course, the NBC reporter revealed it live in her conversation with the DNI, Dan Coats. So that's an example of real-time, impetuous, geopolitical insanity.
Yes. You know, what can I say? Many of us have predicted this from before the election because If you see Donald Trump not as a normal human being like almost everyone else on Earth, but you understand that he has a very severe psychological deficit, namely that he's a sociopath. It's a also called antisocial personality disorder. Once you see it that way, then it all makes sense. As an effective con man, you remember the mayor of New York, what was his name, Bloom? He spoke at the Democratic National Convention.
Mayor Bloomberg, yeah.
Yeah, Mayor Bloomberg, who was a Republican, who said Trump is a con man, and that's right. So people have trouble accepting that he is so different from normal. So it's one shocking thing after another if you don't see it that way. But if you do, then it all makes perfect sense, and we can all predict the future once you accept that. He is unable to empathize, genuinely empathize, with others. He's certainly able to fake empathize with others, as he does. That's how he got elected. He says, I'm going to make all of you people great, same technique that Hitler used in Germany in 1932. But it has nothing to do with them. It all has to do with him. The allegations, multiple allegations, I think you were just talking, referring to, of his money laundering for Russian oligarchs and Putin, make perfect sense. I mean, this is a man who is doing things for himself and only himself. And the fact that he lies or the fact that he is impetuous fits with that, because his contact, to speak specifically to your comment about his impetuosity, he is in loose contact with reality when reality is a challenge to him. So when things are going well, he can appear magnanimous and he can appear friendly and all of that. But if he's challenged, he can't accept challenges. He can't accept any way in which he would be less than wonderful and omnipotent and omniscient. So he has to lash out. He has to. It's not a question of a deliberative matter for him. He doesn't consult with others. He doesn't think about the long-term consequences. He thinks only about what he needs to do to protect his own sense of his grandiosity in the moment. He's been forced to retract on various occasions, and usually the way I've seen it is they tend to be things written for him, which he then reads, and it's completely different from the way he speaks and acts when he's not reading somebody else's material. But it all makes sense, sadly. That he would unravel under the pressures of having to listen to other people, pay attention to what other people need, conflict, so forth, it's not only was predicted, but it will get worse, as we're all saying it. My greatest worry is that as the Mueller investigation proceeds and he becomes more and more trapped as Republicans, in order to save their own skins, begin to abandon him, that's when I think we will be at maximal risk of his starting a war or attempting fundamental change in democracy, denying the Supreme Court's power and all that kind of thing. Sounds outrageous, but it would be consistent with him.
Well, of course, the excuses he's given are really in the category of the dog ate my homework. He meant to say
right.
Wouldn't instead of would. Why anybody would believe him is beyond my understanding. But the fact that he on a daily basis is trying to stay one step ahead of the sheriff, and it's obvious that he's deeply guilty and he's coming up with all kinds of daily stunts to distract the press and also to feed his base, which so far has seemed to be sticking with him, that my sense is that it's like he's under this pressure of, I don't know what I'd heard of that it's called, you can correct me on this, of narcissistic mortification. In other words, that's the worst thing that could happen to him is reality intrudes to the point where he has to recognize that he's a complete amateur and a complete incompetent, and he's making a complete disaster of the presidency.
Well, I think that is absolutely true. For a very long time, people have been accurately diagnosing him with narcissistic personality disorder. But if he only had a narcissistic personality, that wouldn't be so bad, frankly, because there are a lot of people with grandiose visions of themselves And some of them actually do some good. Some of them have been presidents in the past. But he is sicker than that. There is a fundamental kind of emptiness inside of him, a lack of ability to understand reality when it differs from his view, and therefore a lack of empathy or real concern for anyone else. That's not true of all people with narcissistic personality. So that's why a more accurate term, it's not that the other is wrong, but a more accurate way to describe him is as a sociopath, I believe. It is terrifying. I think he's unique. I think Nixon had some of that, and maybe in a different time period, Nixon would have been somewhat similar. But I think Nixon was a manipulative con man, but not as deeply troubled as Trump.
And again, I'm speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts who have contributed to the recent book Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. So given that Trump craves the acceptance of Hollywood and the celebrity culture, which he really wants to be a part of. And the other day, by the way, he was addressing a group in the White House. I can't remember what they were talking about, job training or something unrelated. He then went off on this, you know, off the teleprompter and talked about The Apprentice. Oh, that was a great show, you know. And he almost was wistful about when he was a celebrity, or at least in his own mind. So if he's so desperate for approval, and as you know, Lance, Hollywood celebrities despise him, and he can't really claim too many stars on his flocking to his banner. So, is there a level? Is he capable of humiliation? In other words, that to my mind would be the worst thing that could happen to him. The fact that he's afraid that he's not being, or upset that he's not being adored, even though he said your favorite president in the recent tweet. Is it possible that also could be? Is he capable of being humiliated?
Well, that's a great point, because I think that goes to the heart of what I was trying to say, that I think he is capable of being horrified and massively existentially threatened by being humiliated. But whether he actually feels humiliated, I think if he could feel humiliated, he would be a healthier person. But I think it's exactly at that point that he distorts reality. He loses touch because he can't do it. So since he can't stand that, he just changes the reality so it isn't occurring. People who are critics of him are lying. It's fake news. So as the pressure increases, I think, and this is the same way, it comes to the same issue, as the pressure increases and as his humiliation is as a complete failure as president, and a failure in multiple ways, as that increases, he will distort reality more and more. For example, it would be consistent with him. Again, I'm not predicting this. But how do you think he could be removed from office? What if the Congress impeached him? He would be in a rage. He would do whatever he has to do to deny and prevent this from happening. And if the Senate ever convicted him and he was thrown out of office, I don't know how you'd get him out of the White House, you know? I mean, he would invent a crisis. So I'm not trying to be an alarmist. I'm just saying that I think that when you're absolutely right, he can't stand it, and he will do anything to change it, including changing reality. He's in a position of power to change reality to suit him, which is what's so terrifying.
So, what about the 25th Amendment? Does the same problem apply to that?
I think so. I think that it's hard to imagine how he would be if he got cornered completely. Mm-hmm. I mean, in his own businesses, as you were pointing out, when he has to deal with other people, it's a different story. He's an oligarch. He's a dictator. He's a tyrant in his own businesses, and no one can stop him because he owns them. I mean, we're seeing now that perhaps he owes the Russians because of their supporting him financially. But it's hard to imagine. There was a movie. My goodness gracious! The salesman is finally, who's calm and smooth throughout the whole movie, finally gets trapped, and he has basically a psychotic episode lying on his bed. I can't remember the name of the movie now at the moment.
Glenn Ross, was that one?
Yes, it probably was. Maybe. Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah, and it was a striking scene, wonderfully acted. But it's that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It's intolerable.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, Lance, we're talking about Trump being more and more unhinged and the idea that this he's under pressure from the narcissistic mortification of the reality of his incompetence and amateurism becoming overwhelming. But to my mind, it's not just Trump we have a problem with. It's the American people, or at least 40% of them. Why are they going along with this? Why are they refusing to see the obvious reality?
Well, I think it's the same as why Hitler was democratically elected in Germany. The people want a leader, not all people, but many people want a strong leader who will protect them. That's the goal. And so things like democracy are much less important to them than that. So dictators have regularly had huge majorities of people in favor of them, at least at the beginning, because that's what they say. They all say what Trump said: I will make you and your country great again. I will give to you what I personally need, which is a sense of enormous power and value and money and everything else. It's all lies, but people would like that. That would be nice, you know. I mean, we had feudalism for a long time, and there was a king, and people loved the king. As long as the king, almost no matter what the king did, because the king represented a powerful, valued person with whom they could identify. It's like a kind of hero worship, but much worse.
Well, just in closing, though, what do you think it would take to break that spell? Because he obviously panders to his base because he knows that's all he's got.
Right.
So what would break the spell?
I think that... for some people, I mean, they're not all bad people who support Trump. So for some people, eventually, their sense of decency and rightness and their own morality, which Trump lacks, would become more important than what they see as defending a man who represents them. He would no longer represent them because he would be too far from their own personal values. For some people would stand by him forever. But I think that we're all hoping that the Mueller investigation finally convinces Republicans, who are actually the Republicans in office, are more important than the people in a way, because they're the ones with the true power to do something, but they won't. But I think that when people finally see that he doesn't actually represent them, that's the glue that holds them to them. He represents us. He is standing for us against those bad people, whoever they are, the bad liberals who would support so-called un-Americans like blacks and immigrants and so forth. Once he stops representing what they think is themselves, then I think they'll break away. And then the next crisis will be, who is Mike Pence other than, you know, the lapdog for Trump? And I don't know the answer to that one.
Well, Lance Dodis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. My pleasure.
And again, I'll be speaking with Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, who was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Dodis is a contributor, along with 26 other psychiatrists and mental health experts, who have contributed to the recent book, Assessing President Trump, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the irony that Nicaragua, under Daniel Ortega's increasingly brutal dictatorship, is beginning to resemble the Somoza regime, which Ortega helped topple in 1979.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jeff Thale, who is the Vice President for Programs at the Washington Office on Latin America, a leading research and advocacy organization advancing human rights in the Americas. He follows hemispheric trends as well as U.S. policy towards the region and oversees the Washington Office of Latin America's work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Thale.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Jeff. And Nicaragua sort of somewhat, or the violence in Nicaragua has somewhat gone under the radar. Obviously, we're focused a lot on the civil unrest and the gang violence and lack of personal security in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala, which has prompted a lot of immigration here to the United States. But conditions in Nicaragua seem to be unwinding, and there's a fear, I understand, amongst the citizenry that President Daniel Ortega's brutal crackdown on protesters is returning the country back to the age of the Somoza dictatorship, which ironically, of course, Ortega himself helped topple in 1979.
Yeah, so I think you make a couple of good points there. One is that, compared to the rest of Central America, Nicaragua is a much safer country, much lower crime rate. In fact, it's had economic development in the last few years, and therefore much less of a flow of migrants north toward the United States. And so it's gotten a lot less attention. On the other hand, you know, Daniel Ortega has been in office since 2006. He changed the Constitution to stay in office for a third term and possibly longer. He's gotten increasingly autocratic over time, and in April, there was really a major sort of blow-up, protests against Social Security changes and tax increases connected to that led to much broader student unrest and unrest by young people. The government responded with pretty surprising brutality, frankly, and that brutality sort of inspired yet more people to go to the streets. And so here we are 3 months later, just after the anniversary of the Nicaraguan Revolution, and there are between 300 and 400 people who've been killed in the protests, the vast majority of them protesters. So it's actually a pretty sad situation.
And more recently, of course, there was a clash at a church on the campus of the National University where students were killed. And then the so-called Sandinista youth wings, these paramilitary thugs, have taken over or have run the students out of a neighborhood of Managua.
So this has been particularly ugly. I mean, for the first couple of months, protesters were attacked. Paramilitary thugs, as you say, youth groups and others, attacked protests and demonstrations. In the last two or three weeks, the government and supporters have really increased the aggression, and they have tried to retake universities in some towns that have been up till now pretty much controlled by the young people in the opposition. So there's an especially ugly incident where government allied forces retook the campus of the National University. Protesters have been occupying it, fled to a church, and government allied forces attacked the church, wouldn't let ambulances in to take out the wounded. At least one person died. It was a very, very ugly, ugly situation.
Well, in terms of the comparison between the previously peaceful Nicaragua and El Salvador, for example, Nicaragua's homicide rate in 2017 was 7 killings per 100,000, and neighboring El Salvador's murder rate was 60 per 100,000 in 2017, and Honduras's was 43 per 100,000. So you can see the contrast there. And what's your sense of what leverage other countries or the OAS have? Because I think
that's a really good question. Because I think it's pretty clear that the opposition's demand is that Ortega and his vice president and wife Rosario Murillo resign, and that there be a series of changes in the constitution and the electoral council, and then elections to set a new government in place. The government has resisted that. They have clearly dug in and taken a very hard line. And it's going to take a combination of internal pressure and from the opposition and pressure from the international community to make a difference. Now, historically, the United States has a bad reputation in Nicaragua, played a bad role in Nicaragua in the 1980s and the early 1990s. So the U.S. leading that kind of effort is probably a bad idea. But I think the international community, more broadly, the OAS and others, have the potential to play a useful role in putting pressure on and agreeing to help kind of mediate the dispute and seek out a settlement that's acceptable.
And in terms of an outflow of refugees, so far, my understanding is that most of the young students fleeing these government thugs have showed up on the Costa Rican border.
That's right. There. I was just looking at the numbers this morning. The number of Nicaraguans seeking political asylum in Costa Rica is several hundred now, and that's a big increase. I think the people are fearing being not just attacked at protests, but being personally targeted. There's an ugly story in the Texas papers today about two Nicaraguan Americans who were with their families on a farm in northern Nicaragua, and who were kidnapped and mistreated. So I think people are fearing that kind of stuff, and we're seeing an increase in the number of people fleeing, but mostly they're fleeing to Costa Rica because it's the next country to the south and clearly makes a lot more sense than fleeing to Honduras.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Thale, who is the Vice President for Programs at the Washington Office of Latin America, a leading research and advocacy organization advancing human rights in the Americas. He follows hemispheric trends as well as U.S. policy towards the region and oversees the Washington Office of Latin America's work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. NBC News has an extensive article on what happened to Marco Novaya, a 25-year-old student who is both a Nicaraguan and an American citizen. And he was absolutely brutally tortured in a sort of makeshift prison. And it's quite grim, and it's hard to believe that the government could reduce...
It's reduced to this... Two things about that. One is, as I said, I think we're seeing an increase in not just sort of broad-scale repression of demonstrations, but selective targeting of opposition leaders, and I think that's a very troubling thing. That's one. The other is, Daniel Ortega himself spent 7 years in a Nicaraguan prison for revolutionary activity, and Sandinista activists in the war against the Somoza regime were mistreated, tortured, disappeared, killed. So it's particularly ironic in an especially bitter way that the Nicaraguan government and their allies would engage in this kind of stuff today. And it's sort of a sad comment about what the, hopeful revolution of the 1980s in Nicaragua has sort of ended up with today, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I met Daniel Ortega back in the 80s when he was visiting Los Angeles along with the foreign minister and the former Catholic priest. And
Miguel Descoto. Uh-huh.
Descoto, yeah. And he was a real cold fish. Descoto, of course, was very friendly. rather, I won't go.
I mean, I think Daniel's he can be a very charismatic leader in public, but you know, look at the guy was jailed for years, helped lead a revolutionary triumph. I mean, he's a very focused, very determined, and very single-minded guy. And I think since he came into office in 2006. He's decided he doesn't want to leave, and he's committed to doing what it takes to keep himself and his, probably his wife and vice president and members of his family in power. So,
but when you talk about members of his family, Rosario Murillo, his wife, her daughter accused Ortega, Daniel Ortega, of sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse for many years.
Many years. And she, the wife, abandoned the daughter for the father. So
yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I think these are, obviously no one knows the inside of the family, but I think what Soyla America said is very credible. I think it's really troubling that Rosario abandoned her and her claims. Yeah, I think it's a pretty terrible thing.
So you've got the Catholic Church playing a very positive role in a difficult situation. They keep trying to mediate. They keep asking for new elections. Ortega obviously doesn't want to have an election. He's totally lost the street, hasn't he? He's lost his country.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really striking thing, right? At first, you just had some old age pensioners and some students and environmental activists in the street. Demonstrating, and I think the repression led to pretty broad opposition. And yeah, I think Daniel has lost the street, and that's pretty important because I think for many years he governed from the street, and having lost it, I think poses a long-term threat to his political base and his leadership.
But doesn't he somewhat rely on foreign investment?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the interesting things, right? The United States has been, especially our State Department, right, been a big critic of Ortega for his left-wing views, his support of Venezuela, his relationship with Cuba, and all that sort of thing. At the same time, the Commerce Department, U.S. Commerce Department, gave the Nicaraguan government an award for its free trade-oriented policies, and the Nicaraguan government, has formed, surprisingly, a pretty close alliance with, until very recently, with big sectors of the business community. So, yeah, it's had a very business-oriented policy. It's relied on the business community, and it relies on international investment and tourism to keep the economy going. So that's going to be a challenge. That's going to be a challenge for them in the coming months.
Well, that's obviously their Achilles heel. Is there any way there can be some kind of boycott?
So that's an interesting question. I mean, there's legislation in the U.S. has imposed targeted sanctions on key Sandinista leaders, so taking away their visas to come to the United States, frozen any bank accounts they have here, that kind of thing. There's a proposal in the Congress to suspend have the U.S. vote against loans from the World Bank and the IDB to Nicaragua. I actually think things like that we need to think about carefully. I mean, in 1961, 62, we went down that road with Cuba, didn't overthrow the Cuban government, caused enormous damage and suffering to the Cuban economy without producing the kind of changes that at least the U.S. government said it wanted at the time. So I think you need to be a little careful. I think you need to build pressure. I think you got to think carefully about what kind of pressure and how you do that. So I wouldn't support a broad embargo. I would support selective, targeted pressure to try and force the government to the negotiating table.
Well, there was a proposal to build an alternative to the Panama Canal through Nicaragua, which Ortega, I believe, was pushing hard with. I think there were Chinese investors, but it had massive environmental
right. This was a
consequences.
Yeah, so it's never been clear to me that the Chinese money to build this canal was really going to come through, but there was tremendous environmental opposition in Nicaragua and tremendous opposition from small landowners who saw their property being seized for what could be a canal in the future. So it generated a lot of domestic opposition, a lot of concern about the environment and what it would mean for Nicaragua in the future without bringing any real benefit except to the companies that did land surveys and a set of financial intermediaries. So,
well, I imagine, at least I don't expect anything from the Trump administration in terms of an enlightened policy. Stupidity of way they've dealt with Venezuela by Trump threatening to send the military down there, which has done
the worst sort of thing you could do. Yeah,
exactly. And so, and also, recently the former head of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, said that there's no way in the world you're going to ever solve the southern border issue with immigrants, particularly now with this horrible policy of separating children from their parents, etc.
Right. I mean, on that one, you know, you made this point already, right? You look at the homicide rate in El Salvador and Honduras and Guatemala. You look at the economic insecurity. You look at domestic violence. And until something is done, people are going to continue to feel enormous pressure to leave. And where they're going to wind up is the U.S. southern border.
But
wall won't stop that.
Sure. But the Trump people are just throwing money at a bunch of their crony contractors and feeding these people frozen, toxic sandwiches with green bologna and making money. And they're cutting funds for reduction of gang violence in El Salvador and Honduras, these programs that the State Department had that were actually very effective at going after the violence at the root, because that's the point I wanted to make about what Jay Johnson said. Is you're never going to solve this problem unless you address the social conditions and the lack of personal security in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, and now perhaps even Nicaragua.
Nicaragua, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think you think about what you need to do in that region. You need to invest in youth violence prevention. You need to invest in job creation. You need to invest in communities, not in, not in either cuts in aid nor in aid that's focused on trying to stop people at the border. That's not only not going to work, it's likely to be counterproductive.
So what's your expectation in terms of, obviously, we've made the point, and I think it's pretty clear to almost all the observers I've been reading about their reports from Nicaragua, is that Ortega's lost the street. He's just another deluded autocrat like Assad. Of course, Assad looks like he's won if you can win with a devastated country. So, you know, you don't want that scenario for the 6.2 million people in...
I think we're in for a tough period here, is the honest truth. I don't think Daniel is going to give in easily. And I don't think his opposition is going to give up. And despite efforts to intimidate them and, you know, shoot your way to victory, I don't think they're going to give up. So I think we're going to see continued pressure. We're going to see continued opposition. Sadly, I think we're going to see continued deaths. And I think the key thing is for, you know, those of us in the United States and elsewhere to support constructive pressure by the international community, like the Inter-American Human Rights Commission at the OAS, to try and push the government away from abuse and back toward the negotiating table. I don't think that's going to happen tomorrow, but I think the Nicaraguans are going to keep at it, and we need to as well.
Well, Jeff Thaler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for calling.
And again, I've been speaking with Jeff Thaler. He's the Vice President for Programs at the Washington Office on Latin America, a leading research and advocacy organization advancing human rights in the Americas. He follows hemispheric trends as well as U.S. policy towards the region and oversees the Washington Office of Latin America's work on Central America, focusing on human rights, citizen security, and economic opportunity in the region, with a particular emphasis on El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.